There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.
You're listening to the Bite Size Business Breakfast, our daily podcast wrapping up what's happened on the show and what's happening around the world. First, today's business headlines.
DubaiEye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae.
The Saudi Aramco IPO will most likely happen next year, the Saudi oil minister has confirmed. Khalid Al-Falih told Bloomberg they were waiting for market readiness. Separately, Mr. Al-Falih also said that OPEC and other oil producers could start to boost oil output in the second half of this year.
Dubai is set to get a stock exchange dedicated to listing and trading shares of free zone businesses. The project is the brainchild of the Dubai Airport Free Zone Authority, or DEFSA. The exchange aims to let companies tap capital in the region.
Tomorrow is the final day that UAE companies can submit their first tax returns. The FTA is urging businesses to hit the deadline in order to avoid paying administrative penalties.
DubaiEye 103.8 Business Headlines.
In association with insurancemarket.ae. Compare insurance for your car, health, home or business with insurancemarket.ae.
There's been one big story over the weekend, one big story, four initials, GDPR. I don't know what your inbox looked like this weekend, but mine was chocker.
Well, it was full of it.
And not just because
the emails were
me.
Full of it, and the inbox is full of it as well. This is the General Data Protection Regulation Act coming in Europe on Friday. It affects European citizens wherever they are in the world. That's the key thing.
Well, it affects everyone, because if you've got any customers, you've probably got European customers in there somewhere, and you can't really weed them out, although companies are trying. There are a lot of IT firms that are allowing firms to geo-block European countries effectively while they try to come to grips with GDPR, but we also know that doesn't work particularly well because people move.
I had an email over the weekend from a hotel that I regularly use in Bournemouth overlooking Poole Harbour, and it said, I'm sorry, our relationship's over, effectively. And then I said, well, I don't want our relationship to be over, please. And I scrolled down. It does say, look, if you'd like to continue receiving stuff, click here, which I had to do. Many of them just said, look, if you're happy to receive stuff, don't do anything. I actually like the opt-in method, so where I can sort of choose whether I want the relationship or not.
Which is interesting. Companies have either gone for opt-in or opt-out. And the opt-out messages, I can see why they're doing that, because we know there have been dozens of studies showing that when it comes to either opt-in or opt-out, we're quite a lazy bunch as a species, humans. And it's why governments often, when it's things they care deeply about or they think are good for your well-being, things like pensions or savings schemes, automatic savings schemes or donor banks, they make it opt-out because they know that most of us won't get around to it.
And you may remember, Brandis, I went to Seattle to visit Microsoft about 2 and a bit months ago, and they were really gearing up for GDPR. That was the first time I'd ever heard of it. Actually, it was in Seattle, not in Europe. And I spoke to the Assistant General Counsel at Microsoft, Allison Howard, and I wanted to know why they, as an American company, were so big on what effectively are European regulations and why it's having an impact on the rest of what Microsoft does around the world.
Microsoft is a global company offering global services. We need to apply our data protection approach on a global level. Part of that is just to make sure that it's scalable. And part of it is because I think some of the aspects of the GDPR are fundamental human rights around privacy that should apply globally. And so that's how we're going to approach it. A key area for that is around data subject rights and providing individuals control, giving them transparency around how we're processing their personal data, allowing them to access a privacy dashboard that will be available to our customers around the world. Those are some of the key ways that we're addressing the GDPR and how we'll also help our customers, regardless of whether they're data subjects in the EU or they're in the US or in Asia or Latin America or anywhere.
I also asked Allison Howard whether or not they are looking at sort of reversing those European laws into the US via Microsoft.
Despite the fact that Microsoft has supported having a comprehensive privacy regulation in the U.S. for some time, I don't see us pushing for the U.S. to adopt the GDPR, though we will be acting as if we have, because we will be treating our services the same in the U.S. versus the EU.
I also wanted to know whether GDPR would redefine our concept of privacy and personal data worldwide.
I don't know if it's a fundamental redesign. I think it is a good focusing of privacy practices and really understanding how companies are collecting data, securing data, using data, and providing transparency around that, both to their customers, whether they're individuals who are customers or enterprise customers, or to regulators.
There's a couple of really interesting questions around GDPR for me. One is whether we're ready for it here in the UAE, because even if you're sitting in the middle of the Middle East, if you have data on your customers and your customers are expats, there's a very good chance that some of them are from Europe. Worldwide, the data analytics firm SAS, or SAS as I secretly like to think of them, they've done a study. They reckon that only 49% of firms across the globe are actually ready, because the deadline was this weekend, wasn't it? And people are still sending emails to me now.
I guess the question is it, do we really care? Do I care whether somebody really continues to have me on their list and send me the occasional slightly annoying email? Or is it like Y2K, it's just come and it's gone and that's it?
Well, whether or not you care is probably not the point. I mean, the whole idea of GDPR is actually for you. For everybody. You're supposed to be able to ask companies what data they hold on you. You're supposed to get detail about what they've done with it, if they've given it to third parties, if they've shared it, if they've sold it, all the rest of it, which is what's tricky for companies to be able to have all that data available if you want to access it.
But if most of these companies have already got my data, are they going to have to destroy it? That's the key question.
No, they just need to tell you what they are doing with it. But I imagine if you opt out and say, no, I don't want to have anything to do with you anymore, then yes, they probably do.
Well, they have to. The right to be forgotten is built into this, but not completely forgotten. There's some data which they're entitled to. What jumped out at me was the penalties.
Oh.
If you don't comply, massive, aren't they? Really?
Which is the thing. It's not this, for me, the big GDPR issue is not whether or not you feel happier about your data. It's the fact that if companies don't do it, regardless of what their customers think, they are going to end up potentially with some massive penalties.
20 million euros or 4% of your annual turnover around the world.
Whatever's bigger.
Whichever's larger. So it's, you know, 20 million euro plus.
And big companies are taking this seriously. I mean, we've had a list this morning that Emirates has provided us with telling us what they've done. And they've stressed that it isn't just an IT issue. They haven't just turned round to someone in IT and said, it's your job, make it work. They've said it's multiple departments across the whole group, Emirates and Danata. They've set up a data privacy office to coordinate. But every single aspect of the business is having to get involved. You can't just make this one person's problem. It's also about reporting data breaches, and we've spoken quite a lot of them on this show over the last few months about big name companies who have come out and said, we just want to let you know we had a data breach in 2015, to which you think, well, it's a bit late now, isn't it? They've now got 72 hours to notify authorities if they have a data breach. Slightly lighter note, but no less important if you care about things like the future of the planet, straws are still making headlines.
Yes, a couple of reasons. One is they had an extraordinary general meeting at McDonald's where they took a vote on whether or not to move away from plastic straws. Only 8 or 9% of people thought they should. Surprisingly, very, very low, actually. That's what's jumped out in the headlines. And the food packaging giant Tetra Pak has said that plastic straws serve a vital function in cartons. And I think they're talking about the little tiny drinks carton where you get a cellophane packet on the side, sellotape to it or glued on. And they say that they are developing a paper straw. It's not quite ready yet, but they see that plastic straws are vital.
I see this as a company who just doesn't have an alternative yet and is panicking a little bit.
You get the impression, don't you?
That is a personal opinion, Tetra Pak people, but I think if they'd come up with a solution, they wouldn't be defending the plastic straw.
I kind of, I mean, this is not really sort of focus of the business breakfast, but I think it must be much harder to design a paper straw that doesn't get squashed on the side of those little cartons. Because then there'd be nothing worse than buying a juice and actually putting a straw in it and going, and you can't get it up.
Maybe they need to think out of the box, ho ho ho, and come up with a whole new drinking way that doesn't involve a straw whatsoever.
A retractable straw. Maybe a corner of the carton that pops out and you just suck from there.
I've bought guns. I'm not giving ideas,
for goodness sakes. I'm not on the books.
Do you know what? I think for me, the thing that has leapt out so much about Strawgate at the moment is their extraordinary meeting with McDonald's, which does feel quite extraordinary from the fact that 92% of those voting didn't think the straws were a big issue. And if you take aside the whole not killing the planet issue, and I can't believe I've just said that, even if you have no environmental consciousness whatsoever, and you'd hope that they do, from a sheer PR point of view, do you want to be known as the company where 98% of people kind of were like, nah, oceans, dolphins, whatever? So I just think it's a bit of an own goal.
I still also think, when I think of plastic, I think plastic bags as being the big global scourge, not straws. I know that straws have been very much in the focus for the last few weeks, but I'm guessing that bags are probably still the major problem.
A lot of the bags now, though, are biodegradable. This is the thing. So a lot of the bags already break down, and there are rules in a lot of countries where you can only have biodegradable bags now. The problems, one of the biggest problems with plastics is actually the little itty bits of plastic that you don't think about, because you don't know whether you can recycle them or not. Big plastic water bottles, yes, you put them in the recycling because you know they can be. But those little filmy bits that come on... Yeah. Instant noodle sachets and things like that.
I went back to my dad's house a few months ago. We were clearing out the house after he passed away. And he was, like everybody did, I suppose, you rolled your plastic bags up from the supermarket, pushed them into a big sort of sock-like container so they were always there. And I went into this to try and get a plastic bag, and there were 5 million little tiny bits of biodegradable plastic sitting there. Not one
had biodegraded.
Well, they had. They'd all fallen apart. Not one of them was a bag. They'd gone down into smaller bits, which would eventually, presumably, biodegrade. But there was not one plastic bag left in that bag.
But on the other hand, how brilliant to know that they actually do degrade.
They do work. They sit there and they kind of fall apart.
That's actually made me really happy.
So the smaller bits. I mean, I guess the plastic... If a dolphin swallowed a tiny bit of plastic the size of your fingernail, it wouldn't make too much difference. But if you swallowed a bag or a straw, obviously it's going to play havoc with the internal digestion system.
This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
You're listening to Winning in Business on the Business Breakfast.
In association with Al Namous by Dewar.
Power connection in one step in 7 days.
Sunday morning on the Business Breakfast means Winning in Business. This is our new feature where we speak to business people about their successes and the philosophies behind them. This morning, we spoke to Linda Mahoney, the chairman of Better Homes, a woman who, 30-odd years ago, was a single mum working from her dining room table here in Dubai. Today, she is head of a business that is a household name with 500 employees.
Linda, good morning. Nice to see you.
Good morning, Richard.
Let's recap the Better Home story. 1986, you're living in Dubai, you're a single mum with two young children, and you decide to set up a real estate brokerage. Seems incredible looking back. Now, take us back to that moment in 1986. What went through your mind?
Not much. However, it doesn't seem that long ago to me, although for others it does. And I came to Dubai in 82, 83 with my husband and two children. And I had been in the medical field for many, many years with my husband, who's a doctor. And when he left and we separated, I decided that I would do something different. And I'd had a couple of people I was with at the time when I found my accommodation and learned a little bit about real estate and felt that it was something that would transpose very nicely because it was a people business, as is medicine. So no investment much. As you say, the dining room table, well, it could be the dining room chair. And I just started one by one, finding a place for expatriates to live, going to the landlord. And you just wear many, many hats in a case like that. Any startup business does.
I guess there was no RERA back then. You didn't have to be a licensed agent. It was just a case of if you could do the deal, then you could take the commission.
You needed a trade license and, above all, a car. But you're right. It was very unstructured because we have to remember in those days there were no sales. It was only rentals. So we really considered ourselves rental agents, and we did a lot of learning on the job. But it was really a lot of people engineering and finding property and landlords and putting people together.
And how did you go from the dining table to having a business big enough for a small office? We'll get to how you then scaled that to one of the biggest, if not the biggest, brokers in Dubai. But that first step.
Oh, very organically grown. One person joined me, another person joined me, and that was the way it happened. And before I knew it, I had 6 and 12. And then for a while, that was the way it went. We all just dug in. And hopefully I found, or for the most part, I found people who had the same, I felt, work ethic as I did. And honesty and the customer were important. And you can manage that with a number of people. That's a small number of people. And then from there, we needed more things. We needed computers. We needed, because don't forget, there were no faxes, no emails. Nothing at the time.
Not even a fax?
Not even a fax. And then fax came in, and eventually other people had faxes so we could send papers rather than running across town. But for a long, long time, we were running across town, keeping in mind no mobile phones and we had pagers. Now, that was way back then. So as these things changed, everything else changed at the same time, very rapidly.
And then you scaled from that, which is still essentially a cottage industry, to something much more. And I remember hearing this story just after the financial crisis, because so many real estate brokers went bust in 2008, 2009. It was really booming in 3, 4, 5, 6, and you did well. Many went bust, but you survived. I remember asking you how you did that. And that's an interesting story. Tell us how you got to that position.
I guess to jump forward, when 2002 sales came into play, everything changed and many, many companies opened up overnight. And obviously we stepped up to the plate, but we had been, I had always felt like we were refreshing as we were going along. And so when sales came into play overnight, we had to ramp up. But I had been doing that with property management all along. So it wasn't a completely overnight change. But I think the answer to your question is by putting the money back into the business. It's essential. So many people make some money and then they feel they can start spending it. But I think that's a big mistake with startups.
How did you cope with the property downturn that we did see after the financial crisis as an employer? I mean, how... Yeah. As an employer in what is traditionally a commission-heavy business, weather downturns and look after your staff?
We had to cut back, and that was tough. But had we not cut back, we would have seen some very dark times. And I think you have to be really, really strong about it because you have to let people go, and that's never easy. But it is really the only way. It was the only way.
Because before that, we had almost the opposite. I mean, a few years before, people were giving up their day jobs and going off to sell property. Every second person you met
was an expert.
Was in property, exactly. I mean, to be honest, how did you cope with the flood?
I think that's not as much of a problem as the other way around, to be honest with you. People coming and wanting to work is always quite a joyful thing. But in answer to your question, I think being hard-nosed about it is what's most difficult. And for me, that was probably my most difficult time. But can you ask me that last little bit again?
Well, I'm interested in how you cope competitively when all of a sudden you've gone from having maybe one or two competitors to 50.
Yes, to many, many more than 50, actually. Several things. I think the main thing was that we had other services. We had a basket of services. We had property management, consultancy, sales, and leasing. And it's interesting that what you said just said now is that people were coming in droves. Many, many of our leasing agents immediately wanted to go into sales. When sales fell, the sales agents wanted to be leasing agents. It's so human, isn't it? It's just a natural thing. But we did have a basket of services, which I think really helped us through that time.
So here we are today. Better Homes is one of the market leaders, 500 or so agents. What's going to happen to this industry, not over the next 30 years, none of us can see that far ahead, but over the next few years with things like artificial intelligence disrupting so many industries? And we've had people on saying, was it just last week, Brandy, saying that essentially through artificial intelligence and the way that that's going to list properties, the only thing you'll need an agent to do is open the door of a property to let someone in.
Mm-hmm. I've seen properties where no one's opened the door. It's just been open.
It's just been open. Yeah, where does this industry go from here, and how are you preparing for the next generation of real estate brokerage?
I wanted to also mention that in back in 2002, when sales came into play, my son joined the company, and we grew it together. And then he took over a lot of the modern thinking, moving into the digital period. And of course, with artificial intelligence, nobody really can see the future from that perspective. But what Brandy's just said, she's seen villas without an agent. It really doesn't work that way. I mean, you have to find the stock, but actually there will be human interaction all the time. You can even, in medicine, you have artificial intelligence, but you still need people behind it. So I think it's more, in my opinion, it's more about handling problems as they come along, because artificial intelligence is not one of them, I don't think. We see Uber every day, and look at what's happened with Uber. Has that caused major problems? I think it has been an asset. I use Uber as one example, whether it's Kareem, Uber, or whatever. All these things have added to help make things more efficient and smoother. So I think the digital real estate is not something that we don't enjoy. We enjoy getting into it, and we've been doing that really from the day the website came out.
And as someone who has worked here through several real estate cycles, up, down, up, down, up, down, where do you think we are, honestly, at the moment?
You know, it's very difficult to say, and I'll tell you my reason for saying that is when you start a business, you can make a little plan. But, you know, we didn't know the Kuwaiti stock market was going to crash in 86 or 87. We didn't know the Gulf War was coming in 90. We didn't know the Asian currency crisis was going to happen, the second Gulf War. And then, of course, the financial crisis. So unless you know the plan for all of these things, you can project. But, you know, we really can't project which way it's going. All I can say is that Dubai is doing everything they can to motivate and stay current, which is exactly what Better Homes is doing, is staying refreshed, staying modern, and it's a marathon.
Finally, Linda, can't let you go without asking for your advice to people who are starting their own businesses in Dubai today. It's 32 years since you started yours. What would you give to someone in that position today?
Starting a business is to remember that it's a marathon and not a sprint, and to not lose sight of the customer. It's so easy to do when you're growing, and especially when you get a little bigger. So listening, learning, improving, innovating, and then if you throw honesty into the mix, I think it's a pretty good formula.
Linda Mahoney is the founder and chairman of Better Homes. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. Thanks very much indeed for sharing your story.
Thanks, Richard. Brandy.
Winning in business on Dubai Eye.
In association with Al Namous by Dewar.
Power connection in one step in 7 days. This is the Business Breakfast.
Stay one step ahead with Dubai Eye 103.8.
We've been talking quite philosophically about the concept of time this morning. Working hours. This is something we discuss quite a lot on the Business Breakfast, because there's been a bit of a movement recently around the world for companies to adjust working hours, experiment with shorter working days, shorter working weeks, and look at the effect on productivity. And of course, it's Ramadan, which means many people in Dubai will be working Ramadan hours or working alongside someone who is. We've been speaking to Neil Shah, the Chief Distressing Officer at the UK's Stress Management Society. We began by asking him about the relationship between time and stress.
Time is an interesting concept. It's a theory. It doesn't actually exist. It's just our way of understanding the universe. And, you know, without getting all kind of left field and esoteric, the amount of time that you spend at work is largely irrelevant. It's the state that you're in that will determine how much you get done, how productive you are, and the quality, efficiency, and performance that you're able to put in whilst you're at work.
Which is interesting, because time at work is having a moment at the moment. And we'll get to Ramadan hours shortly, but let's look at some radical experiments that are being done around the world. We've interviewed a New Zealand company here on the Business Breakfast that have reduced the hours people are working, not the pay, but they've brought them down to 4-day weeks. There's an Australian company we know as well that has gone to a 5-hour day. And one of the reasons they're doing it is because they want people to have more work-life balance. What do you think?
Yeah, I think conceptually it's a fantastic idea, but if you're working 5 hours a day in a state of extreme stress and you're under pressure because you're thinking to yourself, I've only got 5 hours to get everything done. If I don't get it done, I'm going to be behind my objectives and KPIs, and that's obviously going to result in a kind of a negative consequence to me. Operating from that state is not necessarily going to equate to you getting more done, being more efficient and more effective. I think we need to consider how can we maximize people's chances of success, not really looking at the amount of hours they're spending at work. We've done time and motion studies. We found that actually people that work the longest hours are the least productive, because you get to a point where you're tired, you're fatigued, you make mistakes, you can't think clearly, you can't problem solve, you can't think laterally. And actually, all those extra hours you're spending at work are resulting in no extra output.
Which would suggest that maybe an enforced lower hour day is a good thing. No? Yes?
See, I'm not into enforced anything. For example, in France, they've enforced that you can't send work emails after 6 p.m. I think it's draconian. The moment you start treating people like children, they start acting like children. Some of the best examples we've seen of companies that maximize well-being are where the working day has been abolished. You turn up whenever you want. You can work from wherever you want as long as you get the job done. Where you're valuing and treating and respecting someone like an adult and allowing them to make the best decisions. If you have a young family, maybe you work during the time that children are at school. When they come home, you get on with whatever you need to do with the family. And then maybe you finish off something later in the evening. I think that, for me, is a much better way of approaching things. So people are fitting their work around their lifestyle and are able to work at times and periods when they are most productive, not restricting them to a working day or even a working office.
But in terms of stress in the office, how much of a contributing factor is sort of working hours, working pressures, as opposed to, say, things like bullying or territorial ambitions, people trying to jostle for extra cubicle space or that desk near the window? What actually causes the most stress?
I don't think we can clearly say one thing causes more stress than something else. It just very much depends on your working environment. There are so many different factors. Now, all of these factors all contribute to your well-being. And obviously, the amount of time, the amount of pay, the physical working environment, the culture you have at work, the equipment and technology you have, all of these could be factors.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, that's probably fairly obvious, but you are the Stress Management Society. You must know sort of roughly what are the most important things causing stress.
Yeah, for me, the top one would be culture, the working culture. Do you feel valued at work? And there are a lot of people that sadly don't feel valued. And that is one of probably the biggest factors that will start to have a negative effect on your well-being.
You know, worrying about one's worth.
Yes, and absolutely. When a soldier goes to war, I used to believe this romantic notion that they're fighting for king and country, where actually they're not. They're fighting for their mates, the person standing either side of them. When you turn up for work, what are you fighting for? Are you fighting for the people standing either side of you? Do you believe in the organization you work for? Simon Sinek wrote a really fantastic book called Start With Why. Companies that have a strong why, a strong purpose for existence, are the ones that tend to foster a better culture, have better morale, and people tend to feel much more valued.
So how do companies at the moment, we're in Ramadan around the world, but here in the UAE, a lot of people will be working Ramadan hours.
Sure.
How do companies structure those hours to make sure that they're not increasing stress and that the work still gets done? What kind of pointers could you give about managing those hours?
Absolutely. And obviously, as I'm all aware that the working day has been crunched, so people starting a little bit later, finishing earlier so they can get home to break the fast and that kind of thing, which, you know, conceptually is fantastic. However, if we are not doing enough to support people during a time when they are going to be more tired, they're going to be dehydrated, they're going to have brain fog. In fact, from what I understand, it sort of road traffic accidents increases significantly this time of year, particularly in the afternoon at the end of the day when people are rushing home to break fast. So what can we do to ensure that people have the best chance of being productive and efficient? And maybe it's at this time of year not necessarily just crunching the working hours, but allowing people to work from home. I know there is an expectation, particularly in the region, where people need to be seen to be at work.
We do have a small tendency towards presenteeism, I think, across the Middle East. Yes,
absolutely. So if I could give a piece of advice, actually having a little bit of flexibility around the work day and the work location, you know, and giving people the freedom to work from home, I think could be a significant benefit. And also, you know, it takes more people off the road and reduces the chances of accidents and injury.
Where do you see that happening the most? I mean, in this part of the world, do you see it a lot? Flexibility over work location.
Well, I think this is something we're starting to catch on with. The workplace, it stays a numbered. You know, there are many companies we work with in Europe that are basically rapidly doing away with the fixed desk and the fixed work location, where people are being encouraged to work from home, because actually, you're treating people like adults, and when you treat someone like an adult, the chances are over time they will respond to that positively.
Part of belonging to a company is having a desk in some ways. I mean, you actually have territory. You're kind of, that's part of you. Once they do away with your territory, surely that alone causes stress, that you're sort of one step removed from the company itself.
And I think this is where a big piece of work around the culture needs to take place before you can just remove the physical working environment. And I think this is where we've now got a generation coming through that see the world differently, that they connect to and subscribe to something more than a desk and a physical working environment. There are many ways that we can foster that culture without the need for a physical desk and a physical working environment. But I think this is, as I said, like, this is where the culture and the working environment need to go hand in hand. You can't just change the working environment or change the culture without the two supporting each other.
Thanks very much for joining us this morning. Neil Shah is the Chief Distressing Officer at the Stress Management Society in the UK. We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
You've been chewing on the bite-sized business breakfast. Thank you for listening. We're back tomorrow.
There's just so much more to hear.
Download our podcasts at DubaiEye1038.com.